the third question I'm going to be talking about today is, we'll lead back into these 2 points, which is that the CFO tends to always look for the hard numbers, the return on investment. And it's extremely hard sometimes to provide these. What are the metrics or milestones might appeal to the CFO to keep him on your side? So we're coming back into really a theme, engagement with leadership. Engagement with leadership running a company, or engagement with leadership who's got the financial responsibilities. What we did is we talked around a number of different things last time, and I'm not going to go over those and rehash them. I'm just going to throw up 3 or 4 thoughts to you, Brent. I'm going to let it go from your point of view in a minute. I liked a couple of quotes I was finding the other day. Money does not flow from ideas. It flows from leaders. I quite like that one. It was by Henry Doss. So it's maybe one. Second one was, leadership is the alpha and the omega. And I thought, that's an interesting one. I don't know if I'll buy that one, but I'll throw it into the mixing pot. And thirdly, how do we ignite entrepreneurial action? And have we got, besides all these nice leaders that we're talking about, we've got a lovely middle management perspective, which sometimes blocks the poor old entrepreneur being able to even influence leaders. So I'm just prompting and triggering and getting us back into a moment of time, which is a few days back. Now I'll leave it to you, Brent, to sort of come back and we start a conversation here. So the question that we're really going for is the CFO one, but hey, I don't mind. Let's just rake over the coals on a couple of other ones that we had.
I'm sometimes too harsh on the middle managers. I think everybody's sort of too harsh on the middle managers. I think that with respect to scaling these innovation practices across the enterprise, I talk often about you need a pincer move, and the pincer move is getting the front line, the grassroots behaving in this entrepreneurial way, and then you need the leadership, the C-suite, saying, yes, we are going to work differently, and then they're going to launch and implement and enforce, you know, sort of this idea around new ways of working, and the people in the middle are the middle managers. And I think that the biggest problem there is that it's almost like we refuse to change their incentive plan. They're so tied into making their numbers on the execution side that it's sort of unfair that we expect them to change, even though we don't change the incentive plans. And it really gets back to, you know, Clayton Christensen's innovator's dilemma. It's really the middle manager that suffers the dilemma the most. They make rational decisions based upon what they think is correct for the business and what's correct for their career. And yet, you know, they find themselves with a bunch of people doing a bunch of other things that they're supposed to support that doesn't advance what they think is rationally correct for the business and their own careers. So I think that I still think that the pincer move is correct, but I think that there's a lot more we could do organizationally in order to incentivize those people monetarily, you know, performance measurement wise, to support working in this new way. I also think that for some companies, that's almost just a generational thing. People will retire and younger people will move into those roles and they will have already established that mindset. And so part of changing the company culture and going through this transformation is just going to take time. So,
But is there, I think you're right. I mean, they are the arguably the block. Maybe it's a generation thing. Maybe it's just the way you see your particular role. As you say, you're out to protect assets. You're out there to be judged on how effective and how efficient you are. What would you, given a chance as an entrepreneur in an organization, what would you want to try and just get your middle manager to sort of say, well, how about using this as a metric? Or how about we both judge each other on this point or that point, and see where that takes us both? Because as you say, it's a lot to do with gaining confidence, allowing people a recognition that innovation is different. Any thoughts?
Yeah, so So I think that if you're acting entrepreneurially inside the organization, then you should be gathering empathy, should be developing empathy for your customers. You're running experiments and you're generating evidence where there's uncertainty. You can actually do all of that without your middle manager's permission. And so I think that what you do is find opportunities to act in that way, run experiments, generate evidence. And if you share that evidence with your managers, then that is what they're going to respond to. And so if you have hard market evidence of how the customers are responding to something, then I think rationally those people will respond to that evidence. And again, I call it training up. And what you're doing is acting in a particular way so that your bosses, your managers, are responding to the evidence, not just to, hey, this is what I'm going to go do, or hey, I've got a great idea. So how you interact with them invites the type of response that you're going to get from them. Yeah. And so if you can get them bought into generating evidence, I would guess that most of them will go, well, have you thought of running this type of experiment? Or that's a great piece of data. What about this assumption over here? And again, they'll start coming up with their own ideas that are working within that system. And I think that's how you start gaining that confidence.
Yeah. I think that's really good, because as you rightly say, you're going to appeal to them because you're taking it in small goes, small bites. You're getting, I can say, them to identify with some success, because they'll be able to show that success through the evidence, through the experiment. And as you say, they're going to be very encouraged, I think, to just let you run a little bit more within that frame and just enable you to build out, because their confidence is just going to grow from, as you say, that ability to go back to somebody else and sort of say, here's the evidence, here's what it was about, here's why we did it, this is why we think this is a good idea. And it validates enormously, I think, a lot of the metric performance that he actually is under, that middle manager.
Agreed. And I think that, there's a common theme in all of these things that we've discussed, is that the internal entrepreneur, the intrapreneur, has to act like a startup inside their own organization, where their middle managers, the leadership, the CFO that we can get to, those are customers in a sense. So yes, you are also their customer, but you have to develop empathy for these people. So you have to understand what it is that is driving their motivations. What are their aspirations? And so the more that you understand what's driving them, then the more you can figure out ways, or you experiment with ways, to make progress in working in this new way. I think instead we tend to have a contentious relationship with those people. Oh, they'll never let me to do this. They already, the entrepreneur already assumes the answer is going to be no. They've been shut down a million times. But the whole point of being an entrepreneur, even out in the startup world, is you get said no, 99 out of 100 times. But once you get to the one yes, you're off and running. And that's true with both customers and with investors and partners and other stakeholders. And so the entrepreneur internally has to have that same mindset. I'm going to get told no, but it's up to me to develop an empathy and experiment on methods so I can get to yes.
Yeah, absolutely right. I think, we always believe that outside of where we're operating is always so much better than our good selves. And as you rightly said, we get ourselves rather fixed in our own mindsets. We moan and groan about everybody else's. But take the positive, take the high road, which is, as you say, relate and build up and as you say, keep pushing. And surprisingly enough, you're going to have a higher level of tolerance in a bigger organization than you ever do actually in a startup. Because a startup, once it's lost its whole sort of momentum and its movement, it's very, very hard to go. We have to shift and we have to change. But when you're in a large organization, people are going to say, hey, this guy's got something. He's determined to, push and keep pushing and keep coming back. And that's rated really highly in large organizations.
Yeah, I agree. And the one thing I would say is there are colleagues that, you know, these entrepreneurs, there are colleagues of these entrepreneurs whom they have not discovered yet that are on their side. And there are middle managers that they have not discovered yet who agree with them and would be on their side. And the same thing all the way up to senior leaders. So part of the job is just to find your tribe inside that company and then figure out as a group, what can you run experiments on? How can you start generating this evidence? What are tactics that we can use to expand this inside the organization? And so, you know, we've worked with companies that are at the very beginning stages and it's really painful. And frankly, when I'm talking to them, I feel just like when I'm talking to an early stage startup. It's really more about inspiration and convincing them that they just need to hustle. And that's the number one criteria in the startup world is hustle. It's even less about all of this lean innovation or lean startup stuff. It's who's willing to go and knock on the doors and break down the walls and persevere. Those are the people that actually make the change they want to see.
Absolutely right. And it's valued, I think, all the way up the organization. But what about this hard guy, the one that's, you know, got the numbers, you know, got the lock and key under all the dollars you want to go and spend? How are you going to talk him around? How are you going to get him into that, you know, entrepreneurial type of spirit? Is he any different from the others?
He or she is probably a harder nut to crack, but I think it's the same. And, you know, we've developed what we call a Zoom tool, which is really an empathy tool. And we've designed it specifically for CFOs. And you know, if people would like to take a look, they can reach out to me. But the idea is the first questions, and again, our methodology is that you would write down what you think the CFO or the finance person is going to say. So you're documenting your assumptions, and then you go and try to have these conversations. Maybe it takes more than one, maybe it's two, maybe it's more. If you could take that person out for lunch or coffee, it's great to get them out of their office and their environment, their context. But the initial questions are really around their philosophy of finance. What is their background? Have they managed public companies? Have they done private companies? Do they have a CPA background? Do they have, you know, a Big Five consulting background? What has been their mindset that brought them to this role as CFO? What is their biggest concern about the company from a financial perspective? What would they like the C-suite to pay more attention to? So a couple of questions like that in order to understand what her mindset is. What is she worried about? What keeps her up at night? And this is the way that we can develop empathy. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, he's walking in their shoes.
Right.
Other words, work it all out and just talk around the people that are around that CFO and try to understand what, as you said, worries them or they're focusing on, because you come back to what you just said. The more you can tell people about evidence, the more you can show people experiments and how you think, you are showing that you are prudent. You are actually somebody that is minimizing the risk where it's possible. So is a CFO going to say, that's not a good thing? I'm going to say, well, this is a great thing. How about thinking about doing this as well that will help me? And suddenly you can get into a conversation because you're dealing actually in their language.
That's exactly right. I love that you use the word prudent. So if you're a CFO in a public company, you actually have, like the CEO, a fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders. So think about those type of words that they are using really in the US anyway, on a quarterly basis. So stewardship, financial stewardship. You want to learn that language, and then what you have to show the CFO is that you're going to be a good steward of the funds that are being allocated for your innovation practice.
Yeah.
And so what does that mean to the CFO? What are the metrics you would like me to report back to you? How often should I report back to you? Typically, they go through an annual budgeting process. So why not propose, well, let's do it quarterly instead, because I want to share with you the metrics as we're making progress, as opposed to just once a year. Ask them, well, what would be your response if we returned unallocated or returned our allocated funds because we discovered that the market was not sufficient or that the solution was going to fail? Now, to most finance people in large companies, that's going to be a revelation. What, you're actually returning the money instead of spending it all so that you get the budget approved for next year? So you start having this conversation where we're going to be good financial stewards. When we prove that a solution will not work, we will return these unspent sunk costs in this innovation program. Now, of course, over time, or what you want to happen is that that money is reinvested in the innovation program and not that they go and pay somebody a bonus. But the act of returning that money demonstrates this fiduciary responsibility and this stewardship. And so they're actually going to ask for really super typical finance type metrics. And so then you need to start the conversation. And this is what you were just getting at, Paul, is you have to start the conversation. Well, what are the, since I'm reporting back to you quarterly now instead of annually, I need to be able to give you metrics that demonstrate our progress towards revenue. And so here's some of my suggestions about what those metrics might be. You know, it starts out maybe number of customers that we're talking to on a weekly basis, number of experiments run, and then those grow to here are the 10 customers that are joining our advisory board because we've validated that they have the problem, they like our solution, and now we're co-developing with them. Next might be, okay, now we've got 10 customers, so a small number, but it doesn't matter, it's progress, 10 customers that are actually engaged in the minimum viable product that we built. So you want to be able to demonstrate to them quarter over quarter, and even more often if they're willing, what are the metrics that actually demonstrate progress towards revenue? And so in that way, again, you're training up, you're giving them insight into how these startup metrics work. And now you're talking about, listen, you're only going to give me the next tranche of money if we agree that the metrics demonstrate that you should give me the next tranche of money. And that's also a way of returning these unspent but sunk costs that were allocated for that project to begin with. So these type of things will build that rapport, build that empathy, and you're actually also just starting to instill the practices and the pro forma for how you handle innovation projects.
I mean, again, you picked up on, you know, chunks of money, nice bite-sized pieces of money. That's what happens in a startup. That's what happens when you're talking to venture capitalists. You know, you're round one, round two, round three, seed money, whatever those questions are. Well, that's, again, talking the language of a financial guy. He's going to understand that you're not looking for big sums of money initially. You're looking for something to experiment, validation. Thought here is, with the whole lean movement, how does the CFO, or how does he grab that? How does he see that as something that's important to him to either understand or even to employ in himself or in his own team? Have you come up against that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there's a couple of ways that we've approached that in the past. And one is that when a internal startup team that's running perhaps as an accelerator, so they're full time on this idea, is that you have somebody from the finance team participates on the startup team. And so what we're trying to do is, in a very easy way, expose those finance people to the what innovation means and what this work looks like. So that's one way to start, you know, kind of infiltrating into the finance team this lean innovation principles. The other way is simply to convince them to run a workshop themselves. And so the idea there is that they have certain business challenges inside the finance group. And those could be, you know, it could be that the budget allocation process is broken, or their business units are not returning funds that they should be, or whatever are some of the challenges that the finance team faces. One of those could be, how do we better support innovation teams? And so we teach that finance team to act like a startup. They do empathy work, they run experiments, and they use evidence to make decisions. And so that's a way for them to get a deep dive, and they can understand that where they face uncertainty, they should use these same principles. Yeah. So those are it's tough when you get up to the CFO. The CFO is, you know, 90 plus percent of their time is spent on execution mode. You can put them on a on an innovation board that is evaluating the progress of internal startups. And so in that way, they can get exposed to the type of metrics. So there's little ways to get them, you know, early exposure. And then there's kind of the deep dive where you actually get them through a workshop and they run the process themselves.
And also, usually a CFO has got a group of people around him that he wants to actually prepare for maybe broader management roles or better understandings, because, you know, he's got a ticking clock against himself, most probably, and he needs to find a way that he could say, well, look, let me bring this guy into your team, and he will then learn some of your principles. He will bring it back into our team. And as you say, he's able to get two or three people around him that he's enormous confidence in, because they are people that are actually managing the money side or managing the relationship side in the organizations, the controllers, etc. And they suddenly have got themselves huge opportunity to work in areas that they wouldn't be exposed to without that. So that's another way of going to a CFO and saying, look, besides finding out about who they are, what they are, but how can we within our team help you and your team? And how can the two actually, you know, exchange through different environments? Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, that's right. So ask the CFO, what is their biggest issue they're facing? What is their biggest uncertainty? And hey, maybe as an innovation team, we can help you overcome those obstacles working in this way and put a couple of your people on our team and let's work through that is a great way to establish that. The internal entrepreneur just has to remember that these people are in execution mode 90, 95, 99% of the time. And so you have to allow them to do a mental shift in the conversation. You have to help them do that mental shift in that conversation. So if you're trying to help them solve their immediate priorities, then the CFO completely understands that's execution mode. I have uncertainty. You're helping me this year and next year. That's great. That's a good opportunity for you to say, listen, when I'm talking about innovation, what I mean is establishing, laying the foundation of growth for 3 years from now. I'm laying the foundation of growth for 5 years from now. So part of it is translating the word innovation into something that is tangible to the CFO. If the CFO is struggling today to meet their numbers, and you can convince them that what you're spending money on is making sure that 3 years from now, the CFO isn't in the same situation, you know, again, now you're framing it in a way that helps that person, helps the CFO. And so part of it is the language that you use. If you don't have to use the word innovation, don't use it. If you know, I like translating it into growth. Listen, we're laying the foundation for growth from 3 years and 5 years from now. That's what innovation means. We have to go out and discover new value to create for customers, new markets, and so that in 3 years we're still humming as the product life cycle on some of our existing products starts to wane. All of that is language that the CFO is going to be able to understand. And if he or she is thinking about it in terms of growth, then maybe that's the way that budget gets protected the moment the performance lags in the near term.
Give me a bit more of an understanding of why you believe they're 95% in the execution mode. I think that's pretty high from my perspective, but what do you mean by execution mode? I mean,
Execution mode is the core business, the operation side of the business. You know, in the United States, you have to report your quarterly, you know, your earnings every quarter. So to me, there's really no time to think much beyond 3-6 months. And so if you're not thinking beyond a year, beyond 2 years, then you're pretty much in what I call execution mode. So I think it's a little bit less pressure in other places. And I actually think there's a way to frame this sort of thing to Wall Street so that it does not have to be. This is a choice that the C-suite is making and the board is making to make it a quarterly game. It's not, you know, law by any stretch of the imagination. So that's kind of a separate issue. But as long as they're playing the game that they have to concentrate on their numbers every 3 months, then yeah, I think they're 95, 99% in what I call execution mode, which is the core business, the operational, I got to hit the numbers.
Yeah, I understand it. I get it. I was just wanted to get that clarified. I like the phrase. I was just chewing that over in my mind as I was listening to you, which is what this work looks like. And I think that's a great, interesting little phrase there, is because that could be a great area for just trying to describe something, because a CFO, he's very used to his numbers. He's very used to everything coming towards him. He, you know, as you say, he's in execution mode. And suddenly you're trying to paint a different type of canvas to him, a different type of picture, which
That's
is
right.
what this work really looks like. I want to pick up on that and give that a bit more color if you can.
Yeah, sure. So I, like you say, they're used to facts, right? They're used to, you know, hard numbers. There's not a lot of uncertainty in those numbers. And what we're actually trying to expose to them is this concept of uncertainty that is under your control, right? So there's sort of uncertainty that we can't worry about because there's nothing we can do about it. But things like market risk is uncertainty that we can actually do something about. And so the number one thing that we want to do in our leadership workshops that we do, we often don't have very much time. We don't have several days that we can, you know, go through all of the empathy work that we do with the front line. But the one thing that we really want to get the C-suite through and the CFOs through is exposing assumptions about what's going to happen in the future. And then we hope that based upon the work that they do in the workshop, those assumptions are exposed as being untrue. And these are very smart people that are at the top of these large enterprises. And most of them will readily admit when they've made a mistake, where they are wrong. And so if you can expose the amount of assumptions that they're operating under for this future, and they have the epiphany that they are actually in operation mode or in execution mode based upon assumptions that are invalid, This is what opens up the world for experiments. This is what opens up the world to working this way. This is the key moment that we want to see these leaders go through. Once they are, assumptions have been exposed as being invalidated, now they're going, okay, so I'm sending out all of my teams to go work based upon false assumptions. What does that do to our numbers even, right? So that affects, it ends up affecting the facts. So by exposing this, what we want them to realize that, yes, there's uncertainty. You cannot just execute through uncertainty because you're a smart person, because you've achieved so much in your career. When faced with uncertainty, you have to go and gather empathy, run experiments, use data plus insights to help you decide about what the next action is to take.
But don't you think that there might be a real fear that, you know, they're going to shoot the messenger? The guy that comes in and starts sort of, you know, I mean, an outside person like you or like an I coming in, we can challenge them in an environment that they feel far more safer sometimes than actually hearing that from an internal person, and certainly hearing that from somebody, you know, like an entrepreneur who's maybe much earlier in his career, and, you know, he's suddenly coming in and delivering a number of messages that, you know, their assumptions might be wrong. Their assumptions might be pointing them in the wrong direction. Whoa! How do you give people a little bit of sort of a shield and a little bit of sort of protection that they provide the right type of way to frame that?
Yeah, I guess I would not recommend that the entrepreneur go in and start poking holes in the CFO's assumptions. I think that, again, it's trying to set it up so that occurs to the CFO herself. That's the trick. And so what I was describing is the way we do our leadership workshops. And so that was a way for the CFO to have that epiphany themselves so that they see that they're operating under these assumptions, under specific conditions, under these conditions of uncertainty. So I guess I think that from the entrepreneur's perspective, it's really more about what we were talking about before, the empathy and you generating evidence so that you can start. When you are demonstrating your evidence, when you're reporting back, you want to use the words like, this was our assumption, so we ran this experiment and we discovered we were wrong, so then we did this, and ran an experiment and had these results. So when you're telling your story, you want to use those words around assumptions. And that, you know, so that generates some amount of understanding. You know, if you're able to run, if entrepreneurs are able to run a workshop where senior finance people are able to participate, then that's actually, to me, the way they experience it firsthand. I'm not sure that in just a conversation an entrepreneur should go and try to tackle that one.
Yeah, but I mean, there is a good way, which is the fact that if that entrepreneur has been out to see a couple of the customers known to the organization, respected by the organization, to go validate something. And as you say, some of the assumptions they've found out are questionable, are maybe not right. But it could also be they're not right because the organization isn't listening as well to the changing forces going on in the market. He does have an opportunity to actually say, within my hypothesis or in my test, I came out with these following points because the customer fed me back this.
Exactly.
And a CFO is sharp enough and smart enough to pick up and say, well, hang on a minute. Does this say that we as an organization might be getting our execution model a little bit wrong? And suddenly it opens up a whole opportunity to actually, you know, carefully tread and to be able to sort of talk that through. So they do have that, providing they've got the backing of some evidence coming from a market, coming from a respected customer, then they can actually begin to expose assumptions in a certain way, can't they?
Yes, exactly right. And I think that if the CFO or others on the finance team are skeptical, then that's where you invite them to go along the next time so that they can hear it. They can hear it firsthand.
Or the team member that's been on the team who understands the methodology, and that's the reason why they're on the team.
Exactly right.
And they can align and they can get clearer and they can come back and deliver the message to the CFO.
That's exactly right.
Look, we've had a pretty good thrashing around on this particular one. I'm just going to pause for a minute and then we're going to sum up. Brent, where do you want to sum up? I mean, we obviously had two parts to this interview. The first part, which, as you say, is there. But funnily enough, I think coming out of this question three, it can be very applicable to anything. It could be applicable to the leadership of an organization. It can be applicable to middle management, because the overriding themes of what you were saying was empathy, evidence, experiment. And that can run through a leader of an organization conversation, a CFO, or it can run through a middle management conversation. Any other two or three real good sort of takeaway points that you want to pull out?
I think we covered a lot of ground. So I think that's pretty good. I think that in my philosophy, in our philosophy, I think people can start to understand why we believe that everybody in the organization should learn these principles. Again, it's not that everybody is going to apply them to the same degree, but everyone can define a customer either inside the organization or outside the organization. And so everybody can use these skills of empathy and experiments and evidence, whether they're trying to make the company better internally or externally. And so if you're on the way execution side of the house, but you're serving groups inside the company, then those are your customers, and you can learn to apply this even if it ends up being only 1% or 5% or 10% of your time. And so I think that the biggest challenge that we're facing going into 2018 is going to be the labs that have been operating for several years that are still in a silo, and they need to be able to start providing benefit to the core business, and organizations that really start taking on this big transformation that everybody gets to learn or needs to learn how to operate this way. And so I guess I think that that's maybe a good place to summarize is, as we wrap up 2017 here in the next couple of months, we've seen a lot more organizations that are taking innovation, I think, more seriously in the past. We're getting out of this innovation theater mode. But the next challenge is how do we start moving that into the core business, and how do we start tackling the big uncertainty?